Well, you know, I want to back up just a little bit this lesson and pick up just two thoughts off of the lesson we were working on last week and didn't quite finish. I wanted to talk about that part about heaven being a physical place for a few minutes. It's on, I think, the second page of last week's notes under E. It says heaven will be a physical place. You know, I heard a story one time about a dad who was trying to be a really good dad. And so what he had done is he was going on a trip. And so before he went on the trip, he tape recorded a bunch of little stories that he normally would read to his child every night. And so he had had, you know, four or five books, and he had pre-read the stories into the cassette player. And he brought the kid in and set her down and said, "Honey, I'm going on a trip, and I thought this would be real, really cool. You can listen to Daddy while he's gone." And he showed her how it worked, and he, you know, set her up with the book and propped it all up and all that stuff. And she sat there listening to his voice, and, you know, he was really proud of himself. Thought, "Oh, cool, kicked the big one here." And so at some point she stopped the little recording, and she went over and crawled up in his lap, and she said, "Yeah, it's really neat, Daddy, but there's no lap." And what she meant was, it was great to hear his voice, and it was great to hear the story and all the rest, but to a large extent, the experience was she was in her daddy's lap. She was with him. And that's one of the things about heaven that is so personally attractive to me when I think about heaven, is the fact that it is a physical place. It is a tangible place. It's a touchable place. It's an experience that is not all ethereal or mental or, I'm not sure, you know, 10th dimension. It's real. It's touchable. And one writer was talking about, and I mentioned it in your notes, that maybe what it is that God is not finished with Eden yet. And I think most of you already know this. Where was the Garden of Eden? Physically, where was Garden of Eden? Approximately. Right, Iraq, the southern part of Iraq. How do we know that? Yeah, that's right. There are four rivers mentioned, two of which we can still identify, Tigris and Euphrates. And if you just go down somewhere along the route of the Tigris and Euphrates, the Garden of Eden had to be along there somewhere. And you know, arguments can be made for the southernmost part of it and others further up. But somewhere in the what we would call Iraq. So some authors have suggested that God's not finished with us. Yes, well, he isn't, but he isn't finished with Eden yet. That once he stuck the angel in front of it and protected Adam and Eve from going back in, that at some point he takes that protection off, that guard to that location, and I don't know if it's in a different dimension or how it is that it's secluded from us now, but at some point perhaps he opens the gate and allows us to go back in Eden. And really kind of some interesting thoughts is just sit and read the first couple of chapters of Genesis and think about what it would be like to live in that environment. You know, it's real, it's touchable, it's stuff to eat, work to do, things to do, voices to hear, people to see, things to happen, relationships to have, physical connectivity, intimacy. All of those things were part of the Garden of Eden. So that's one author's idea. I don't know. Another thought is this concept when we talk about the transitional heaven, the idea that we're not quite ready for the heaven that's described in Revelation 21. So we have a transitional or heaven that's not quite the new heaven and the new earth. And Randy Alcorn makes a big deal about that. And in that context, he talks about, you know, having perhaps temporary bodies. You know, the resurrection, the final resurrection of our bodies has not yet happened. So in the meantime, we kind of need a house to live in, a physical house to live in. And you know, there's quite a little paragraph here. Let me read it. "Given the consistent physical descriptions of the intermediate heaven and those who dwell there, it seems possible, though this is certainly debatable, that between our earthly life and our bodily resurrection, God may grant us some physical form that will allow us to function as human beings while in that unnatural state between bodies awaiting our resurrection. Just as the intermediate state is a bridge between life on the old earth and life on the new earth, perhaps intermediate bodies, or at least a physical form of some sort, serve as bridges between our present bodies and our resurrected bodies. Now, all he's trying to do is make some sense of the fact that the resurrection of our bodies has not yet occurred, and yet we're in heaven, so some form necessary. And then, well, but it's not your resurrected, your final resurrected body, because it hasn't happened yet. So that's what Alcorn's trying to do, is give some answer to, well, what kind of body do you have at the rapture? If it's not the final resurrection, what kind is it? And that's where he's coming up with his concept of temporary body. The thing that I do know, I don't necessarily know that to be a fact, and I'm not pitching that, I'm not swinging at that ball. What I am saying, though, is the stuff that it's the next little section of your notes, is that there is a physical nature to heaven, and it's provable. Revelation 6, verses 9 through 11, I think I mentioned this last time, on Alcorn's website, he makes 21 observations about the physical nature of people in heaven out of those three verses. Things like they have to have, they have a voice. If they have a voice, they got to have some sort of a voice box. They got some sort of a voice box. They got to have a place to put a voice box. So there's some sort of a body that holds the voice box, because these people cry out, and they cry out in one voice, not a bunch of different languages, but one voice. These martyrs are wearing clothes in Revelation 6. Well, you don't wear a robe or clothes unless you got something to hang it on. It's got some sort of form. I don't know what it looks like. I don't know if it's 5'2 or 5'11. I don't know. You know, but there's some sort of physicalness to it. There's a term that's used in Revelation that oftentimes is mistranslated as if it were a non-corporal floating suke. Suke is the word, but actually it has to do with the whole person. There's a description of the martyrs as having a whole person. A whole person includes some form of something. When John talks about getting caught up into heaven in Revelation 10, he apparently had some sort of body. He's moving around. He's making observations. He's whatever. He's functioning in some sort of a body. And even Paul, when in 2 Corinthians he talks about getting caught up into heaven, and he says, you know, I'm not sure it's the third heaven. I'm not sure exactly where I went, but I got caught up. He clearly had a body. So when you think about heaven, perhaps if nothing else, dismiss from your mind once and for all that it is ethereal, that it's floating on, you know, clouds, it's strumming harps, it's, you know, no one knows each other, and we're all just kind of blebs, glorious blobs in heaven. And nothing could be further from the truth. Well, let's catch up then on the new lesson today, which I entitled Ruling, Reigning, and Rewards. When I was a young girl growing up, and if you had asked me, what do you want to be when you grew up, I had various answers to that. Almost always, though, the answer was, I wanted to be in charge of something. Yeah, I know, big shock. You're supposed to be nicer to me. But really, I wanted to be a doctor at one point. It wasn't enough I didn't want to be a regular. No, I wanted to be some kind of a surgeon deal, you know. You know, we used to talk in some of the leadership classes in high school, and I wanted to be the president. I did. I still wouldn't mind the job. Vote for me, would you? You know, crazy. Yeah, right. I'd get 17 votes, include my brothers. I always wanted in my mind, I wanted to have something that I was responsible for. I was just that kind of person. I didn't much care about the accolades that went with it. I wanted the job. I wanted the job part. When I became a Christian, and the message that came to me so clear in my heart was one of humility, that part of my old nature that always wanted to be the one on top needed a little chiseling, needed a little work there. I needed some understanding of what servanthood was like. So for the first, 10, 15 years of my Christian life, I spent a lot of time thinking about serving and being at the bottom of the heap, you know. And even in leadership, reading and thinking and writing a lot about servant kind of leadership, I was reorienting my sense about what was important. And somewhere in that shuffle of I want to be in charge to no, I need to be the bottom of the barrel and happy about it, I lost a sense of what we're talking about today. And a lot of Christians have lost it too. And that is, God does reward, and there is a ruling and reigning aspect to the life to come. Because we are called to serve, and it's clear that we are, and because it's clear that we're to serve with a humble heart, remember Jesus's three top dogs, Peter, James, and John. Remember James and John have a little scuffle just before the end of Jesus' time on earth. And they're fussing about what? Who's going to sit on his right hand? Even his mother gets it. Their mother gets involved. You know, I just wanted to know, I got my two sons here. They're wonderful. Which one gets to sit on the right hand? Because the right hand was the position of great glory. And Jesus makes it so clear. First shall be last. Last shall be first. But in the process of understanding that it's my job to serve you and your job to serve me. Don't you look at me like that. I'm looking away from her because she was lecturing me yesterday and she was right and I was wrong, but I don't want to look at her. In the process of learning that serving thing, that humble, you first, me last, that others matter more than self, don't lose the concept that is so clear in our Bible about rewards. And about once those rewards have been given, there's a ruling and reigning aspect to the world to come. Now, don't go the other direction now and then start the, oh, here I'm I, number one, it all should be about me. Clearly, that's not the gospel. But let's dive into this with a little more of an open spirit than I hope you dive into a little bit more than certainly I did in my early Christian days. I put at the top here a reminder, I don't think this crowd really needs it, and that is that our salvation and our eternal destiny is determined by our faith, not our works. I don't think there's anybody in here that's unclear about that. You get that, right? Nobody's earning nothing. We're not getting stripes because we're hoop-de-doos, right? It ain't happening. I think we're all clear. But, there is a reward system, and that reward system is based on a judgment of those works that we do. Our behavior on earth does matter and affects the reward standing and the ruling and reigning aspect of heaven to come. Now, another little introductory thought that came out of one of Bruce Wilkinson's books called A Life God Rewards. He calls it the dot and line concept. And this is very helpful for me. Maybe it will be for you. If you take your pen, most of you got a pen in your lap, reach over in your notes and just put a dot. Just a lot. And then over to the side, you know, put your pen in and draw a line as far as your paper will go. So you got one dot and a line across your paper. That dot is representing the whole of your life here on earth. 75 years or so, 70, 80 maybe, some of us. A little longer, some of us a little shorter. Roughly speaking, 75 years. Everything that you and I think about in our earthly, everyday context is contained in that dot. Now look at the line, which, by the way, never stops. On your piece of paper, it stops because you don't have any more paper. But it just keeps on and going. That's eternity. We spend all of our time and effort thinking about that little dot. And here's eternity. That's helpful for me as I start thinking about some of these specifics. So let's talk about the specific place where the rewarding takes place. We call it the judgment seat of Christ. Or others might refer to it as the Bema, B-E-M-A, seat. A good place to start in your mind, I don't want to turn there because we're going to turn to a lot of passages today, is in Acts 18. Paul gets called before a council, a seat of authority, a place where rules were dispensed. If you will, a courthouse, okay? And 3 years after he appears before that particular courthouse in Acts 18, he's going to write to the church in Corinth. And I do want you to turn there. Go to the second letter to the church at Corinth, 2 Corinthians chapter 5. 2 Corinthians 5, and then we're going to look at 1 Corinthians 3. So 2 Corinthians 5 and 1 Corinthians 3. So 3 years after he gets called to this judgment seat, this council, this courthouse, he's going to write to the pretty nasty church in Corinth and make reference to this courthouse, this seat of authority. So 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse number 10. Let's see, I'm gonna back up to verse 6, I think, a little context. Therefore, we are always confident and know that as long as we are at home in the body, we're away from the Lord. We live by faith, not by sight. We are confident, I say, and would prefer to be away from the body and at home with the Lord. So we make it our goal to please Him, whether we are at home in the body or away from it. For we must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ. You could put in there the words bema, the bema seat. We must all appear before the bema seat of Christ, that each one may receive what is due him for the things done while in the body, whether good or bad. Now, quickly, I remind you, the good or bad, this is not a judgment of your sin. Where was your sin judged? At the cross. So, for by grace have you been saved through faith, that not of yourselves. It is a gift of God, lest any one of us should boast. So now we have what might at first glance appear to be a contradiction. It's not. This is not about the judicial sense of my guilt before God. This is about my behavior from the time I was given the grace of my salvation. So he says, you know, I want you to know, we will all appear before the judgment seat of Christ, that each one may receive what is due him for the things done while in the body, whether good or bad. Now, 1 Corinthians 3, go there. 1 Corinthians 3, and, we'll start about verse 9. For we are God's fellow workers, you are God's field, God's building. By the grace God has given me, I laid a foundation as an expert builder. Paul's talking to the folks that are fussing about all the divisions in the church. One was saying, you know, I'm from Paul, and the other, I'm Paul's disciple, and I'm Peter's, and so on. And he's looking at those that are doing the divisions and saying, wait a minute. I laid a foundation as an expert builder, and somebody else is building on it. But each one should be careful how he builds. For no one can lay any foundation other than the one already laid, which is Jesus Christ. If any man builds on this foundation using gold or silver or costly stones or wood, hay, or straw, his work will be shown for what it is, because the day will bring it to light. It will be revealed with fire, and the fire will test the quality of each man's work. If what he has built survives, he will receive his reward. If it's burnt up, he's going to suffer loss. He himself will be saved, but only as one escaping through the flames. Now, gold, silver, costly stones, wood, hay, and stubble. Which of those six burns up in a regular fire? Wood, hay, and stubble. What is refined, made even better in a high flame? Gold, silver, costly stones. The bema seat that Paul is referring to is a place where the works of men, those who are believers in Jesus Christ, are in essence chucked into a fire, and after the fire has had its way, examine what's left. What's left is not going to be wood, hay, and stubble. It's going to be burned up. What's left is going to be gold and silver and precious stones. He's going to make that same kind of statement in Romans 14, another couple of years after he was at that council in Acts 18. And he says in that passage in Romans 14, we will all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. And he says, and we're going to give an account. There's that phrase, we're going to give an account. Well, what are we going to give an account of? We're going to give an account. We're going to show, we're going to display, we're going to lay out our behavior on earth. And another way, another phrase that's talked about is it's going to be revealed by fire. In fact, we just read that, revealed by fire. It's going to be tested, and whatever endures is going to be available to be seen. Not all of it will be available. Some will suffer loss. What? Loss what? Will lose the reward for the activity. Now, another way of looking at this seat of authority or council, courthouse, is a description of the Bima. It also comes out of early Olympics. In the early Olympics, when one guy from each village in Greece would come and they'd run their long little marathon, at the end of the marathon, they came to a place, a seat of judgment, a Bima seat it was called. And some dude sat on the Bima seat, and here come the runners, and they come around. And the first dude coming through, winner, yahoo, he got the little crown thing, the little intertwining, I don't know, some sort of vine, and just honestly, yahoo, I'm the hero in Greece for this year. He's the winner. And what would happen is he'd go back to his village and never had to work again. That was the prize. Not bad. Piece of cake. Now, right behind him, you know, another, I don't know how many runners there were, but for the sake of argument, there were 50. Right behind him, there were 49 runners. Now, the second one might have been 2 seconds behind. And the crowd's going to cheer. He did a really, really, really good job. But he didn't get the prize. He didn't get home and never work again. He gets, you know, good job, but he didn't get the prize. He didn't get smacked. They didn't get beat. They didn't get, you know, run through the ringer for not winning. There was a loss, though. They didn't get the prize. So I want you to think in terms of this judgment with great seriousness. One of the quotes there, the Bible treats this judgment with great sobriety. It is not meaningless formality, but a monumental event in which things of eternal significance are brought to light and things of eternal consequence are put into effect. That passage that it's in 2 John 1:8, it says, watch out that you don't lose what you've worked for, but that you may be rewarded fully. That fifth runner coming through, maybe halfway through the race, somebody might have said to him, crank it up a little, dude, because you don't want to lose what you've worked so hard for. Get going. There's three guys in front of you because you want to be rewarded fully. This sense, this focus, this identification of reward is meant to be a motivator for us. Martin Luther used to have a phrase, and if you read some of his stuff, you'll find it in different places, but he captured kind of this focus. He said, I only have 2 days on my calendar. I have 2 days on my calendar. Today and that day. Today, these are the things I got to do. And that day. This day, the Bema Seat day, reward day, that day, the day of the return. If we thought more about the line and less about the dot, we'd be cranking up some rewards. When we spend so much time on the dot, the runners are passing us by. So let's talk about those rewards. Luke 6:23, put it right there on your notes. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, because great is reward in heaven, for that is how their fathers treated the prophets. The word reward there, the Greek word, could easily be translated and is in other passages, wages, what you earned. This is not a superfluous little, you know, how in kindergarten if they smile sweetly, we give everybody a reward, right? This is an earning. This is a wage. I did that which I should have done. I got paid. Here's my wage. The word for reward is really a sense of wage. Luke 14:14. And you will be blessed, although they cannot repay you. You will be repaid. Again, repaired or repaid. A different word, but the same idea at the resurrection of the righteous. To give back in return. You did something and you're getting something back in return. Now, what is this recompense for our behavior? Go to Matthew 16. I forewarned you we had to go to a bunch of passages, and we do today. Matthew 16. So is this rubbing anybody raw? The idea that we're earning something, that we're getting rewards? Anybody struggling with it? Just me, huh? Okay. Matthew? Huh? Yeah, because it immediately starts a comparison thing, doesn't it? We're going to talk about that in a minute. It's not me against you. It's not my work against your work. It's my work against what I could have done. The standard is never me to you. The standard is, what was I able to do with the gifts, abilities, and opportunities that I was given? The child born today in Tunisia to a family that just ran across the border because they no longer can live in Libya, does not have the same opportunities as your two boys. And so the standard is not your two boys against two boys in Tunisia today. The standard is God-given abilities, talents, opportunities, significant chances, and what did you do with them? It's not based on IQ. It's not based on giftedness. It's based on what did you do with what he gave you, whatever it was. The little sweetheart that is the word that we used in my generation, retarded, where the mental capabilities are not there, but in her heart serves the Lord with such display of joy and compassion and care and doing whatever the little things are that they do, I'm behind them in line at the Bema seat. I'm guaranteeing. Because it's not me against you or you against me. It's what did we do with what we got? To whom much is given, much is required. Frankly, less opportunity, less gifts, safer spot to be than someone to whom much has been given. But great point, and we'll get to it. So let's start with Matthew 16, verse 27. I love it when you're listening and fussing through things. Teachers like that, you know. Jesus says to his disciples, verse 24, we're going to back up, talking about that there is a recompense, a rewarding for our behavior. If anyone would come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. Whoever wants to save his life, he's got to lose it. Whoever loses his life, he's going to find it. What good will it be for a man if he gains the whole world and forfeits his own soul? Or what can a man give in exchange for his soul? For the Son of Man is going to come in his Father's glory with his angels, and then he will, there it is, reward each person according to what he has done. I tell you the truth, some who are standing here will not taste death before they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Now, this is the idea of a recompense for behavior. Another parallel thought, Revelation 11, right there in your notes, the nations were angry, your wrath has come. The time has come for judging the dead and for rewarding your servants, the prophets and the saints, and those who reverenced your name, both small and great, and for destroying those who destroyed the earth. There is a rewarding, a recompense, a repaying for behavior. Now, lest you immediately think, oh yes, God owes me something, let's take care of that for a moment. Look at Matthew 20. We're in 16, I think. Turn over a couple pages to the right, Matthew 20. Here's that great parable of the workers in the vineyard, that our culture hates this parable. They just can't think of it as being anywhere close to fair. And I'm putting fair in quotes. It's not fair that people should be paid this way. Go sit in Wisconsin right now and read chapter 20 outside, and imagine how long you would be alive in that culture right this second. This parable is the one about, you know, he goes out in the morning, he agrees to pay a certain amount, and the workers that got there at 8 in the morning agreed to that amount, worked all day long. Some workers showed up at, I don't know, noon. He agreed to the same amount with them. They worked half a day. Somebody shows up 4 o'clock. They only worked an hour. He pays them same amount. The guys who were there at 8 o'clock in the morning, they're not too happy about that. It's not fair. Well, the problem with that is, what's the standard? Back to your comment. Is the standard me against you? I got here at 8, I've been working all day, you got here at 4, you only worked an hour? That ain't fair. Okay, if that's the standard, you're right. It isn't equitable. But if the standard is, did you deserve whatever you agreed to in the first place at 8 o'clock in the morning? Answer, no. By his graciousness, he said he'd do it. I worked, I got it. The fact that he was monumentally gracious to the next person, notwithstanding, it was fair, you to him, maybe not you to me. So when we get into this concept or the recompense for behavior, make sure that you don't get into the sense of, well, you know, God owes me something. Nuh-uh. Not even close. In verse 15, he says in this passage, don't I have the right to do what I want with my own money? This is God speaking. Or are you envious because I'm generous? Yeah, you're God. You can do whatever you want to. The standard is not me to you or whatever. Make sure that you understand who's doing the rewarding. It is God who is doing the rewarding. And it's by his generous graciousness. It's, you know, I am being generous here. I am recompensing. I'm paying a wage. I'm repaying. I'm repairing. I'm giving back on the basis of behavior, and it's me doing it. I'm choosing. Hebrews 11:6, without faith it's impossible to please God, because anyone who comes to him must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. You know, we understand the first part. In order to have faith, we have to understand it's impossible to please God, rather, without faith, and that, you know, we got to believe that he exists. Yes. And the next part is equally as important, and that he rewards those who earnestly seek him. Rewarder is a play on words in Greek of that original word up there for reward. It's the rewarder who pays back the wages in return for behavior. It's all on him. It's not on me and you. It's his generousness, but it's a system he set up. Now, what does God reward? Well, godly behavior in a general sense. I put down in a bunch of verses. He rewards people for seeking him. We're in Matthew. Turn back to Matthew 6. When God is sought, rewards are given. Matthew 6, verse 6. He's talking about prayer here, of course. When you pray, you go into your room, you close the door, you pray to your Father who is unseen. Then your Father, who sees what's done in secret, will reward you. You're seeking him privately, quietly. Not for show, but when you're privately and quietly seeking him, he's making notes. Now, there's a part of us that goes, well, wait a minute, I don't want him to reward me for doing what's right. Now, wait a minute. Do you not carrot and stick your children? You know what I mean by carrot and stick? You motivate your children with a combination of carrot and stick. I know you do. You do. Stick. What's the stick? Goad is the Bible would call it. Okay? There is a point in which when you set guidelines for your home and guidelines for children's behavior, that there's an, and if you don't, a little goad, whatever the goad is. There's a stick. There's a mm-mm, you should have. But carrot, what's the carrot? Out in front. You do, if you do, looky what mommy's got for you. You say, oh, my children don't need that. Oh, yeah? Ha, 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 ha. I need that. Why do we think that we're any different than grown-up versions of these guys? Do you really know someone whose motive is so pure that recognition or reward or acknowledgement is a total non-issue for that person? I don't know anybody. I know a lot of people that are self-motivated, that they don't need as much as the gal across the hallway. But I don't know of a single person, I have never met a person, who didn't appreciate a comment, good job. Maybe they don't have to have a tangible reward, you know, a bonus. I am an incredibly self-motivated person. I've applied for one job in my life. I just had to make sure I wasn't lying there. I actually applied for a job once. I've never asked for a raise, and I've never asked for a certain amount of money. I'm motivated by the job and all that stuff. But, how wonderful it is when someone on our board will end the board meeting going, let's just take a moment and tell Sherry how much we appreciate the way she blah, 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 blah. Oh, hey, well, it's a moment. You know, it's not a check. I didn't get sent to the Bahamas. No, I don't want to go to the Bahamas. I've been joking about that for so many years when you write a check at the counter. Just make that out to the Sherry World Bahamas Fund, you know. I'm just saying that there isn't a person that doesn't appreciate an occasional carrot. We all need the occasional stick, but we also appreciate the occasional carrot. So when God says, hey, I'm going to give rewards for godly behavior, you know, get over it if that's bugging you a little, because he understands human nature. Matthew 24, let's see something else he gives a reward for. Matthew 24, in this one it's talking about being faithful, a faithful servant. So there's rewards for seeking him. There's rewards for being faithful. 24 verses 45, 46, 47. Who then is the faithful and wise servant whom the master has put in charge of the servants in his household to give them food at the proper time? It will be good for that servant when the master finds him doing so when he returns. I tell you the truth, he will put him in charge of all his possessions. When we're doing what he's asked us to do and we do it with faithfulness, he acknowledges that. He notices. And as a matter of fact, when we do well with what we've been given, we get a greater sense of responsibility. And I'll talk about that in a minute. Something else that we get rewards for suffering in his name. Luke 6. Look at Luke 6, verses 22 and 23. For suffering in his name. This is the Luke's version of the blessed are the so-and-sos. And in verse 22, he says, blessed are you when men hate you, when they exclude you and insult you and reject your name as evil because of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, because great is your reward in heaven. Wow. A bit of sobriety for you this afternoon. Go home, get on your internet, go look up Voice of the Martyrs and other ministry opportunities around the world that are supporting those who are not in freedom to serve God when they're suffering just for mentioning his name. Countries like Cambodia, countries like Vietnam, countries like China, countries like Burma, countries like, and there is a long list. Those people who are suffering for the very name of Christ, there is a reward system for them. The dear wife whose husband abuses her because she chooses to raise her children in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord, God is paying attention. There is a reward. Matthew 6, a little bit earlier than a passage we looked at, a little bit earlier in that same passage, he talks about those that give generously, there is a reward. When you are able to give of what you have, and I'm not talking about just money, but where you choose to take some of the things that God has given you, time, energy, opportunity, strengths, gifts, hospitality, food, as well as money, then God acknowledges that and rewards are associated with it. In the exact same way, he talks about in Mark 9, anyone who gives a cup of cold water in my name, there are rewards. God is in the rewarding process. Now remember, he also rewards us according to motives. Now some of us are pretty good at doing the right things, but maybe with a lousy motive. And he takes note of motive. You know, the heart has got to be right. It can't be I just do the right things. It's got to be I do the right things for the right reasons. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 4, verse 5, he says, therefore judge nothing before the appointed time. Wait till the Lord comes, because he's then going to bring to light what is hidden in darkness and will expose the motives of men's hearts. At that time, each will receive his praise from God. Once he sorts out the motive. I used to know a gal in Bible college who was the queen of Bible college. I mean, if there was a job to be done, she was there. If there was a family to serve, she served. In the church, she was the model of whatever. I mean, the way she dressed, the way she spoke, the way she ran her home. She was just a model. And you would think in your mind, okay, don't get behind her in the line at the Bema seat, because you're going to be there a while the crowns are given. The truth of the matter is her life imploded halfway through Bible college because the inside didn't match the outside. So God's concerned not just about the functionality of our behavior, but also the intent of our heart. All right. I hope you're getting a little taste, a little sense of the fact that God is in the rewarding business. There are two books that I gave you at the bottom of your notes, one by Wilkinson and one by Alcorn, that talk a lot about rewards. I'd recommend both of those books to you if you're struggling a little bit. Now the next, aren't they at the bottom of your notes? Suggested reading, A Life God Rewards and the Law of Rewards. Page 5, thank you. Now, what happens with these rewards? Well, there is a sense in which when we are rewarded for our behavior, that we are allowed to rule and to reign with him, that there is a position, a function. Now, I don't know what that is. I told you when we started this study that for many, many years, I used to ask the Lord, could I please be the chief librarian at the Library of Congress in heaven? That was the job I wanted. I still would like that job, as a matter of fact, but I don't know what he would have in mind for me. I do know that 2 Timothy on your notes says that if we endure, we will also reign with him. If we disown him, he's going to disown us. But there is a time and a place, Revelation 3:21, to him who overcomes, I will give the right to sit with me on my throne, just as I overcame and sit down with my Father on his throne. There is a ruling and reigning aspect to this whole picture of rewards. There is a job to be done. You know, in our culture, if you do a really good job, really what you often get is a reward of less work. You know, you did a really, really good job on that project, take the next week off. That's kind of how our culture works. Not always, but some of the time. In God's mind, when we took an assignment, maybe the assignment was raising two kids. You know, I'm not talking about President of the United States. I'm talking about raising two kids. But when we took the assignment that God gave us, the place and the role that God had for our lives, and we do it with passion and commitment and godly perspective, that there is a sense in which God doesn't say, great job, now you don't have to work anymore. What he says is, great job, let me give you five more kids. Let me up the ante of what you can be responsible for. You did a really, really good job. Now, it's not like a kid that's good in math and their teacher looks down and they did their math page and she says, oh, you did that really good. Here's two more for you. That's not that. But it's you did such a good job in the task that I gave you. I'm going to allow you to be responsible for more. You can have a greater impact. Isn't that what the Christian life is all about? Impacting people's lives? Really, that is at the heart of why you and I live. It starts within the circle of your own home, if God has given you the blessing of a husband and children. But it extends beyond that, the blessing to others. That service aspect is at the heart of why we live. Now, when we do that well, God rewards that by saying, in glory, you did such a good job on ruling and reigning in, I don't know, Togo, that I'm going to give you a bigger country. I'm going to give you a larger set of responsibilities. Not in a silly way, but in that the ruling and reigning is acknowledging that you did what you should do. In Revelation 2, you have to remember, in fact, I want you to look at this one because it has an if associated with it. Revelation 2, go to chapter 2. Ooh, time, where did it go? You don't mind sitting here another hour or two, would you? Okay, I don't think that's going to work, so. We'll stop on this point. Revelation 2. Look at verse 26 or so. He says, to him who overcomes and does my will to the end, I will give authority over the nations. He will rule them with an iron scepter and he will dash them to pieces like pottery, just as I have received authority from my Father. And then he goes on. Now, to him who overcomes and does my will to the end, I will give authority. There is an if associated with it. Ruling and reigning has some conditions. He who overcomes, he who keeps my word, he who keeps my deeds, then I'm going to give them authority over the other nations. The caveat is the faithfulness, the behavioral faithfulness to do it God's way. And of course, the big point is greater service on earth yields greater responsibility in heaven. And then there are a couple of great stories that you can anticipate and look ahead and read and study a little bit about the story of the minas and the talents. Let me just stop the lesson today by saying this. Don't confuse service with rewards. In other words, don't say it's either I have to be good as a servant or I have to be focused on rewards. No, it's both. I need to be a good servant, a humble, put you first, others first, me last. That needs to be my mindset. But I must recognize that when my behavior is godly, matches up to the scriptural standards, then there is reward. I'm not motivated solely for a pat on the head. I'm motivated to do what I'm supposed to do and the way I'm supposed to do it, with the right heart attitude. But God says, clearly, I will reward that. So if somehow it's a little crass for you, you're going, I'm working for rewards. Sorry, it's how I set it up. Don't abandon the humble servant others first mindset. Clearly, that's the job description of a believer in Jesus Christ. But recognize that in his system, he's acknowledged there are rewards for that. All right? We'll keep going on this topic. Let's pray. Father, thank you so much for your word, the truth of it. Sometimes it seems paradoxical. Others first, then I get a reward. But Lord, it is true. It's hard to read our Bible without bumping into the word reward. And I can't always understand it clearly, but it's truthfully what's there. We are given a set of standards, a way to live our lives. It's clearly meant to be in service of others. But at the same time, you acknowledge that service with rewards. Father, help us to try to understand it as we plow through the scriptures. I pray it in Jesus' name. Amen. Thanks for coming. It would have been no fun without you.